Goddag og velkommen til Langsomme Samtaler. Mit navn er Rune Lykkeberg. Jeg har i den her uge talt med David Runciman, som er professor i historie på Universitetet i Cambridge. Han er vært på podcasten Past, Present and Future, og han er forfatter til adskillige bøger, som også vi her på Dagbladet Information har udgivet, blandt andet Hvordan demokratiet ender. Han har skrevet nogle fantastiske bøger om den store britiske statsfilosof Thomas Hobbes. Han har skrevet om hykleriet, og han har skrevet om den moderne statsdannelse. Og så har han faktisk også skrevet en lille bitte introduktion til politik, hvor han tager udgangspunkt i Danmark. David Runciman er en enestående intellektuel karakter. Han har et suverænt overblik over den moderne idéhistorie og en enestående indsigt i aktuel politik. Og han formår at bringe de to sammen, så det at tale med David Runciman er ligesom at gå med de store linjer igennem en ellers uoverskuelig samtid og se nogle mønstre, som man ikke havde set før han udpegede dem, men som bagefter gør det nemmere for en at tænke over det samfund, som vi efterhånden har fået opført imellem os. Senest har han skrevet bogen Overdragelsen, hvordan vi gav magten til stater, selskaber og kunstig intelligens, hvor han igen vender tilbage til sin store filosofiske held, Thomas Hobbes, og trækker Hobbes indsigter helt ind i vores samtid i dag. Grundtanken i bogen er, at den moderne frihed er afhængig af, at vi kan give magten fra os, at vi kan give magten til nogle andre end os selv. Selve det, at menneskene lægger deres våben ned og siger, at vi vil ikke slås længere, og i stedet for siger, at staten får monopol på brugen af legitim vold, det er en overdragelse. Det er en magtovergivelse, men det er en magtovergivelse, der giver os frihed og sikkerhed. Og vi befinder os i den her bytterelation hele tiden mellem de her store maskiner, kalder han det, som regerer over os, og vores egen frihed og medbestemmelse. Der er ifølge Runciman tre store maskiner, som vi har givet magt til. Den ene, det er som sagt staten. Den anden, det er de store virksomheder. Og den tredje, det er kunstig intelligens. Hans pointe i overdragelsen, det er, at balancen er tippet. Og det vil sige, at vi løber rundt i en samtid, hvor vi troede, vi levede i demokrati, og vi troede, vi kunne drage vores virksomheder til regnskab. Vi troede, kunstig intelligens var noget, vi selv havde fundet på, som skulle hjælpe os, og kan pludselig ikke styre det længere. Vi har med andre ord mistet kontrollen, og nu ser vi på de store maskiner og ser, hvordan de arbejder sammen. Vi ser for eksempel, hvordan staten og den kunstige intelligens kan lave noget overvågning, som vi ikke kunne forestille os før. Vi ser, hvordan staten og de store videnskaber på nogle områder også kan arbejde sammen på en måde, som helt har taget kontrollen fra os. Så man kan sige, at den der aktuelle fornemmelse af, at der er noget, der er gået amok, og vi ikke har kontrollen over det længere, som klimaforandringen er det bedste og mest påtrængende og mest katastrofale eksempel på, men som også findes andre eksempler på. Den der meget, meget aktuelle fornemmelse, den giver David Runciman et historisk blik på. Han sætter scenen for en anden tilgang til tænkning over politik og filosofi i dag. Og det lyder måske mørkt, og det lyder tungt, og det lyder pessimistisk, og det er der også en del af samtalen, der er. Men når man først har indstillet sig på den måde, Runciman tænker de store maskiner på, så kan man også se, hvor håndtagene sidder til at lave den om. Så handler det, som han siger, om at introducere mennesket ind i maskinerne en gang til. Det er der både noget ekstremt interessant, noget håbefuldt og noget, som de kalder for handlingsorienteret over. Her følger min samtale med David Runciman.
Hello David, how are you?
Good, how are you?
I'm fine, thank you. I'm definitely better than the world is, I think.
Okay, good. Well, that's always good.
Yeah, it's a wonderful book. I really enjoyed reading it. I was intellectually impressed by how much you're able to achieve with a few very, very simple but very broad concepts.
Okay, good. Well, that was it. That was the idea.
It's also a gloomy book, and I share the sense there of a collective anxiety. I think for me, it's more about climate change than about artificial intelligence. Yeah. But the questions raised in the book ask what might the human species, what might end the human species all together. These questions are surprising to me, born in 74, that I should deal with them at this stage in my life. Yeah. You were born a little earlier than me growing up, I guess with the promise of progress and a sense of growing prosperity, at least for a while. How surprised are you about the questions that we're asking ourselves in this world today?
Yeah, so I was born a bit before you, 67. So actually, my first memories of being in a world of politics are of the mid-70s, which was a pretty bleak time, actually. I mean, I remember as a child, so in the UK, the mid-70s were not not a comfortable, friendly time. It was there was a lot of strikes, there was a lot of dissent, there was a lot of protest in the streets. It didn't feel, as a child, I didn't know what was going on, but you kind of felt like it was a bit dangerous, actually. I mean, with me, the contrast is more with the 1990s. I was a student in the 1990s, and the 1990s now look like this weird decade where it kind of felt like things, it didn't feel like the end of history, right? But it felt that things had settled down, and there was a sense of almost waiting for something to happen. So relative to that, to when I was a student, there was the first glimmerings of anxiety about climate change. There was always anxiety about nuclear war. There was very little anxiety when I was a student about AI. I mean, no one talked about it, right? And email, I remember when email arrived and I thought, oh, this is interesting. Didn't spot it was going to ruin all our lives. Then I would say the thing that feels really different to me just in the last 5 years, probably 5 to 10 years, the 2010s were a fractious decade. The financial crisis gave everyone a sense of instability. But what feels different now is just the radical uncertainty. I feel it in my own life. I feel it talking to my children, talking to students. I feel it in the way that there's a sense that what we call politics is missing the bigger picture. That feels new to me. That widespread feeling I think a lot of people have that the systems that we have for governing our world are just missing something. And what it gives people generally is a feeling of a loss of control. And I don't think that existed even 10 years ago. So even after the financial crisis, there was a sort of, politics got very fractious. But I don't remember the feeling that you get now and you hear people talk about now, which is when you think 10, 20 years ahead, it feels impossible. That's the thing that's changed. The 20, 30 year time horizon, when my children think about what it would be like to be as old as me, I just don't think they can imagine it. When I was their age, I could imagine what it would be like to be as old as my father. So that's the thing that's changed.
Looking at your work, both the podcast that you do with the previous book that you wrote, I'm impressed by your ability to revitalize the old canon of ideas, because I feel personally that I was not theoretically, analytically, intellectually prepared for this situation that we're in now. I feel that I was prepared, brought up to understand a bit of the world, but there's lots of it outside it. But it seems to me that you stick, and I say this in a very positive sense, to the vitality of the theories and the philosophy that we grew up with.
Yeah, so the question you asked me to start with, which was about my lifespan. So my lifespan, your lifespan, these are nothing. These are just little accidents in history. The history of modern thinking makes the period that we live through, as every period is, look a little incidental. It's, this isn't the whole of history, right? It's just one little slice of it. And the history of modern ideas, most of it comes from periods which are as turbulent as ours. So maybe not as radically uncertain in some of the ways we'll come on and talk about, the threat to human existence and that feeling that we might be on the cusp of some complete transformation of the human condition. But in the 17th century, in the 18th century, the idea that it was hard to imagine the world in the future without deep anxiety, uncertainty, fear, being driven by fear. These things are all the way through the history of modern political thought. And I do think one of the mistakes, which is probably the quintessential 1990s mistake, is to have the wrong sense of what are the appropriate time horizons. So there is a way of thinking about history where you think that if something's kind of been around for 50 years, like modern representative democracy, 50 years, 70 years, it's timeless. And 50 years, 70 years is nothing. And I think that is possibly the feeling that people are getting now, which they didn't have even 10 years ago. The things that we grew up with, the ways of doing politics that we grew up with, the certainties, the expectations, those things are much more fragile than we appreciated. But they don't look surprisingly fragile when you see the history of the last 300 years, because in the history of the last 300 years, it would be surprising that they were durable because they're recent inventions and they fitted a particular time, and that time may be over. So the history of modern thinking, modern political thinking, is not the history of the last 50 years or 100 years. And so in this book, I go back to the 17th century and thinking about, you know, artificial creatures and all of that in a world that, you know, was as uncertain as our world, and a hell of a lot more violent as well.
You know, some would say today that we should not use modernity as the analytical starting point. They'd say, well, this is a Western story. Yeah. And when we think of modernity as the starting point, we neglect the fact that the Chinese had a state long before we had a state. This would be the point of Francis Fukuyama. Others would say, well, modernity presupposes that nature is predictable and exploitable and a limitless resource. And now we're in a totally different relation with the nature where it's, where it's scary how little unpredictable, how little predictable it is. But you stick to modernity as the kind of analytical horizon. Why is that?
It's a very good question. I mean, I'd say a couple of things in response to that. One of the things I say in the book, and I say it right at the end of the book, actually, is modernity is sometimes conceived as the rational age. I mean, it is Western, for sure. It's a Western idea, modernity. And it does say we're talking about the last 300 years. That is the period of Western dominance. I'm not making a value judgment there. It is just the case that the, you know, the dominant political and imperial powers of the modern world, they have come out of Europe, the United States, and so on. And we have to have some time to characterize the period, which may be coming to an end, and it may have only lasted 300 years. So there's nothing timeless about it. There's nothing eternal about it. But it does have a particular character. But one of the things that I'm pushing back against is the idea that what came before modernity was, I don't know, superstition and magic and myth, you know, and folklore. And then you get modernity, which is rational, efficient, and so on. And then maybe there's this thing called postmodernity, which is fluid and open-ended and creative mashing together of different ideas. Modernity is the strange one. Modernity is the bit in this story where I say at the end of my book that has monsters and ghosts, these things that I talk about, the things that we built in the modern age. They are not simple, straightforward, mechanical, comprehensible, efficient devices. We live in a world full of monsters and ghosts that we have naturalized. We just take it for granted. You know, we live in worlds of states and corporations and these political and economic ways of organizing our life. It's strange, it's mysterious, it's not well understood, but it does have a distinctive character. And the word that I would use to describe it is not rational or efficient, it's artificial. Modernity is the age of the artificial version of the human experience, where we built these versions of ourselves that have a kind of artificial life and durability and that have come to dominate our planet. And I'm making no value judgment in saying that. I'm not saying it, therefore, it's better than what came before, or it's worse than what came before, or the Western way of doing it is better. But that way of organizing the world has dominated for the last 300 years in the West and increasingly dominates the whole of the world. So even if these are the non-Western versions, these are still these artificial corporate entities that dominate our planet. And there is something about that that has to be explained. It has to be understood. And you cannot assume that it is a straightforward story of enlightenment or a straightforward story of oppression. It's a story of machines and monsters. That's modernity.
There's always, in modernity, this tension between artificiality and a quest for authenticity. This is also the era of putting the human at the center of the universe. Listen to the sentiment of your heart as the original source of morality in Rousseau. And the complaint about alienation, you know, people couldn't be alienated before they expected not to be, before they expected to be authentic in the world. The title of your book, The Handover, it could be read as giving away something that used to belong to me, that there's a sense of loss and we had it, then we gave it away. But it could also be said that handover could mean this is something you have to accept, that in order to become a free citizen, you must give up your individual sovereignty, which is this sense that I give up freedom in order to obtain freedom. Which of these two meanings is it that you allude to in the title?
Both. Both of them. You know, I have to say it was a title that was suggested to me by my publisher and I hadn't thought of it. And I liked it because it seemed pretty ambiguous. you could read it in different ways. So it does have some of that second element that you talked about there. One of the things that characterizes the modern age is that there are these trade-offs. You know, in the pre-modern world, it's not like we think we handed something over to God or whatever supernatural power we think governs the universe. It's more, you know, the choices in a way were more fundamental than that. But in the modern age, there is a sense that human choice underpins our decision that we have to give something up to gain something. So it's not just straightforwardly, you know, it's not extortion. It's not a handover in the sense of someone's holding a gun to your head and they say, hand over your wallet. It's not that image of the handover. It's the idea of a trade and a trade-off. That is part of it. And modern politics is built on that idea. Modern economics is built on that idea. The division of labor is a kind of handover, right? You do this, I'll do that. We will take it in turns. We won't do the same thing, but out of this, we will emerge with something better than we had before. But it's also meant to suggest that there are points in human history where we move from one phase of existence to another. And we don't always see them or understand them as they're happening. It's quite hard to know you're living through one of those periods. But with hindsight, you can see them. You can see a shift from a world in which people lived not a natural existence in a sort of Rousseau sense, not a natural, authentic existence, but there was a way of social and political organization in which what wasn't yours was very remote from you, and what was yours was quite centered around you, you know, geographically, physically, personally. You were both a very small thing and a bigger thing, and also your world was the whole world. And in the modern age, there is a transition to a world in which we are much more interconnected. And also we have delegated power and authority to artificial entities that take decisions for us. And that is also a transformation. So it's not meant to suggest that somehow there's a before and after, and we were either better off before or worse off before. We're both better off and worse off because of the handover. And then the final ambiguity is to suggest that we may be going through it again, right? So if you lived in Britain during the Industrial Revolution, with hindsight, you can see you were living through a complete transition of the conditions of social and economic life. But if you were living through them, some people will have benefited. Some people, it was a catastrophe. I mean, an absolute disaster. It's only with hindsight you can see it. If we are transitioning, which we may be, to a new age of information technology, which is empowered in ways we can't really even imagine quite now, our experience of it will not be just a kind of before and after handover. Since this book came out, I've done events with people, you know, AI experts who say, we're going to look back on 2023 as the before and after year. There's before ChatGPT and there's after ChatGPT. And I think this is rubbish, right? Because, you know, I lived through 2023. You lived through 2023. I don't remember like it being a before and after story. It may be in 50 years' time people will think that, but I doubt it. When you live through it, the world after ChatGPT looks pretty similar to the world before ChatGPT. But if you have 50 years' hindsight, that we may be living over a, you know, decade or two through a phase where we can say, actually, there was this fundamental shift and another set of powers were handed over in a way that changed the human condition. I don't know about the second story, so I don't know yet whether AI, none of us knows yet whether AI is that. But with historical hindsight, we do know about the first story. The invention of modern states and modern corporations did represent a handover of powers to artificial human agents, artificial versions of human agency, and also transformed the conditions of human existence for better and for worse. That happened. It happened in different times, in different places, but it happened.
And the premise for the analysis in your book is that what strikes us as entirely new, well, this is a unique time in history, never experienced, not like anything before. Now we are losing humanity. We had it just before. Is comparable to something that happened before that. And that makes the book less gloomy, I think, that this is another stage of a human history that we are familiar with. We've been in these kinds of situations before. It doesn't guarantee anything, but it does provide us with a sense of being a part of a learning group called humanity. Tell us about a little bit about this analogy between what happened then and what you see now.
Yeah, so the idea that I use to try and capture this, it's a slightly technical way of putting it, but the political and economic decision-making entities of the modern world, and I call them for shorthand states and corporations, states are the political ones, corporations are the economic ones, they are artificial decision-making machines or artificial agents. That is, we create these things to take decisions for us and on behalf of various groups of human beings, and we endow them with superpowers. You know, they have a durability, they have an ability to sustain and maintain certain kinds of collective endeavors beyond anything that human beings could do before. They're a little bit like robots in that they are these super powerful entities that do things for us, and we created them to make our world safer and more prosperous and to make our lives go better. And it worked. As I say at the start of the book, it worked. You know, if you live UK, in Denmark, United States, actually now even, you know, China, India, other places, there is a before and after. Before these things were empowered in this way, and after. And after, there is more prosperity, there is more longevity, there is better qualities of education, there is better healthcare. These entities have allowed that to happen, but we've also given them superpowers with great destructive potential. So these things, they're not human. States and corporations are not human, and they can take decisions that are very destructive for human possibility. They fight terrible wars. Modern corporations are extremely exploitative of the natural environment. They can be very short-sighted, and they can be very blinkered, and all of that. So it seems to me there's a clear analogy here with our anxieties about AIs and the next generation of artificial decision-making machines. You know, some people will say that ChatGPT and its equivalents are going to make our lives go so much better. You know, they're smart and they're this and they're that, and they can give us these new efficiencies. We'll get better healthcare. We'll get better education. We'll be empowered. We'll get more democracy. And then there are other people who say, yes, but they might run out of control. They might turn on us. They might not care about us. We have been living that story for 200 or 300 years. You know, if the world ends, it could be because states and corporations, in the end, use their powers to destroy us. You know, if there's a nuclear war, it'll be because states have destroyed humanity. If climate change is completely destructive, it will be because state and corporate power got beyond our control to rein it in. But there are differences, and I'll just give you one. I think the crucial difference is that states and corporations, you know, the United States of America, Meta, or whatever it's called now, you know, Baidu in China, the Chinese state, these super powerful artificial agents, they are not super intelligent. So at no point did we build them to be smarter than us. They don't take better decisions than individual human beings do. Their powers are different. They are powers of durability and scope and scale and so on. Whereas it is possible that these AIs are going to be smarter than us. And it would be a mistake to confuse the two. It's definitely a mistake to think that because the American state decides it, it's a more intelligent decision than if a human being decides it. What it is a more powerful decision than if a human being decides it. And I think that this analogy is really important as well, because it would definitely be a category mistake to think that 300 years ago, 200 years ago, 100 years ago, we built super intelligent machines to run our world. We didn't. We built super powerful machines to run our world. So now there's a temptation that the new super intelligent machines promise to make those machines go better. You know, if you take the American state and if you plugged it into an AI, would you get better politics? Or if you took the American state and plugged it into an AI, would you get even more inhuman politics? That seems to me to be the question.
There's this very interesting, I think I would call it a worldview. I'm not sure it's the right word. In your book, which is somewhat Cartesian, which is not surprising because you go back to Hobbes, who's the contemporary of Descartes and Newton. But there's this division between the human and the non-humans. And this is very important for your analysis, that we should understand this division. It's not the humans against the non-humans. But, you know, many here in Denmark, maybe this is naive, but many would say, well, actually, we experience the state as our collective we. When we want something, we're acting through the state. And when we have young people, now they go in anti-war protests against what's happening in Gaza. It's because they are not alienated from the state. They don't see it as a non-human actor. They see it as an extension of their political subjectivity, and they would not feel fully human without being able to act through the we of the state. Why is that division so important and so absolute in your book?
So I think I'm not trying to say that it's the way to understand the modern age or the world that we're living in is human versus machine. What I want to say is that there are different versions of us which are artificial, one of which are these political and economic entities, states, corporations. So let's say take the Danish state. And then there are other versions of us which are artificial, which are being built at the moment, which are these new kinds of so-called thinking machines that are trying to replicate the ability of human beings to think their way through the world. And as I said previously, these political ones are not thinking machines. But the other difference between them and, say, you know, some version of an AI is they are made up of human beings. They are machines built out of human beings. They are amalgamations of human beings. The state, what are the bits? What are the cogs? What are the parts of the state? You know, this almost sounds like a medieval analogy, but it's not. It's a modern analogy. They are human. Same with economic organizations as well. They don't run without the human components that make them run. So there's always this complicated dance and temptations both ways. You can look at states and mistake them for just these kind of alien, almost foreign mechanical things. And some citizens do experience the state like that. So even, you know, young Danes marching in the streets, they will also have encounters with the state, maybe when they go and claim some kind of benefit from the state. And they feel like they're talking to some computer, and they probably will be talking to a computer, literally, right? It's, you know, it will feel like a very dehumanizing experience. We've all had dehumanizing encounters with the state because we realize it's a mechanical bureaucracy. And then we've also had moments where we feel it's us, you know, sometimes in elections when your side wins, you know, you kick the bastards out, you get your bastards in, and you kind of feel, you know, we really have the power. You take to the streets or whatever it is. And there are lots and lots of different ways in which human beings can come together to produce a sort of collective artificial version of themselves. But I do think it's important to recognize, and I think the mistake we sometimes make is to think that it's purely human. It is not purely human. You know, this isn't a sort of mind-body division in which there's a pure human version of the mind, which you can identify at the heart of modern politics. When you dig into modern politics, it's quite hard sometimes to find the human essence. You sometimes have to search for it, and sometimes it's not there. And it is definitely, I think, naive to assume that in the end, if you look hard enough, you will find in the modern world, in the big institutions of the modern world, the human heart, because there is no human heart. We can try and make them as human as possible. We can try and imbue them with our human qualities. We can look to change the human beings who are part of the machine so that they become more like what we would recognize as a human-centered actor. But they are not human. And the way I can prove to you that they're not human is they do not have natural human qualities, right? If they were human, they would live and die and breathe and reproduce and all of that. They don't. Corporations don't do that. And I spend quite a lot of the book explaining these differences. They have unnatural lifespans. They have unnatural appetites. They have unnatural powers. And yes, we can find in them ourselves. But we mustn't think that therefore what that means is they are like us. And lots of big mistakes are made in politics by thinking that they're like us. You know, if you treat a corporation like it's a human being with hopes and fears and a conscience and a soul and a heart, you will completely misunderstand what you're dealing with. And the consequences can be catastrophic. If you assume that something has a conscience when it doesn't have a conscience, you're in trouble.
And it's like there's almost a temptation in our way of thinking that we tend to say, well, Meta is Mark Zuckerberg, or yeah, Twitter, or X is now Elon Musk. That it's almost impossible for us to imagine these artificial agents without ascribing them some kind of human agency, almost a personality. I think that's part of what you're criticizing in the book, isn't it?
Yeah, it is. I mean, we do it a bit with AIs as well. You know, we try and ascribe to these algorithms human-like qualities. But yes, we particularly do it, and not just with economic entities, with political entities too. We think that, you know, America is Joe Biden, America is Trump, even China, right? The Chinese state or the Russian state, incredibly centered around an individual who is right at the top, Putin. The Russian state is not Putin. The Russian state is a vast, mechanical apparatus, Putin is at the heart of it, and Putin's decisions will feed through that machine. But the machine's ability to sustain a war in Ukraine is not because of Putin's human qualities. It's because of the extraordinary powers of modern political machinery. Same in China. But also, as you say, same with, say, Tesla or X or Meta or whatever it is. And it's also true that it serves the purposes of those people for the rest of us to believe that they are the company and the company is them. They become indispensable. So, you know, all dictators would like you to believe that without them, you know, l'état c'est moi. Take Putin out of the Russian state collapses. I don't think that's true. There might be a civil war, but the Russian state is not Putin and Putin is not the Russian state. Tesla is not Elon Musk and Elon Musk is not Tesla, because the Russian state and Tesla have powers, lifespans, artificial qualities that are inhuman. And I write quite a lot about how modernity, let's call it that, is impossible without these qualities. These entities can sustain projects, wars, investments, also catastrophes. You know, they can drive disasters way beyond the capacity of any human being. And to spend too much time finding the human, and also the mistake that we then make is we think, if only Elon Musk was a bit nicer, you know, X would be nicer. If only Putin was a bit nicer, the Russian state would be. Now, if Putin was a bit nicer, I don't think he would be where he is now. But also, yes, the Russian state would be doing different things, but many of its essential qualities would be unchanged. And I think we spend too much time wanting to swap out the human beings. So we think, swap Trump for Biden or swap Biden for Trump, and we'll get a completely different version of America. And we don't spend nearly enough time thinking about the machinery of the system that they are ostensibly in charge of and how we could change that. And one way I think of drawing this analogy is, if you were to think of, say, a modern multinational corporation or a big modern state as an actual robot, and it was malfunctioning, you know, it was stomping across Ukraine, killing everything in its way, and a human being was sort of riding on the back of it, trying to steer it, you wouldn't think, let's take that human being off and put a nicer person on top. You would think that's ridiculous, that's naive. What you would say is, let's rip it open and rewire it. You know, let's look inside the robot and see what the wiring is, which means it's behaving in these ways. But with politics, and increasingly actually with some of our economic life, we think, let's swap out the human beings, leave the machinery as it is, leave the machinery of the American state as it is, the Constitution, the electoral system, all of the mechanics of politics, you know, the way that money works in the system. Let's leave all that as it is, but let's just put a nicer person in charge. If it was an actual robot, we would know that was madness. We would know that the robot doesn't care how nice the person sitting on its back is. What matters is the internal machinery of the robot. We built it, we wired it, we need to rewire it. But in politics, we spend very little time talking about rewiring the state. And we spend a weird amount of time thinking about, I wish this person rather than that person was in charge.
I think that's a very, very convincing analysis, but it also strikes me as very, very difficult to do what you're urging us to do, because our entire democratic theater is based on the election, the rituals of the election, and they come up with a program. And if you look at Biden, he proposes Build Back Better. We vote for Build Back Better as a way of rewiring American trade policies, as a way of rewiring America's sense of globalization and their industrial policy. And then you say, well, don't spend so much time focusing on the person. Try to think about how the machine is. And I find it very difficult to imagine this as a public discourse with people engaged and on the street. And I feel the theater with the persons is the kind of collective access to these discussions.
It's completely true. And I'm aware that if you say, you know, there are phrases in English like corporate governance or constitutional reform, and it makes people want to shoot themselves. You know, it's like the least interesting sounding thing in the world. The excitement of politics is the personalities. It's the human element. It's communication where we feel we're really being spoken to. And you, the politics of bureaucracy has none of those qualities to it. And of course, I'm not suggesting it doesn't make a difference if you swap out Biden for Trump or whatever. You do get, even as you put it, a kind of rewiring of certain policy choices. But there is also a growing sense of frustration. And there are moments where young people take to the streets and when, you know, it feels like we're regaining control. But the direction of travel, I have no doubt over the last 10, 15, 20, maybe longer period, is that sense of alienation of people from the institutions of representative government, partly because there is a mismatch between the expectation that different leaders can rewire the state and that feeling that it's continuing on a certain kind of path. And on the big existential questions, that is really acute. So climate change would be the obvious example here, where there's a lot of talk about it, there's a lot of theater around it, and there are human beings from Greta Thunberg through to Donald Trump. You know, Greta Thunberg giving the side eye to Donald Trump was great theater, right? The planet didn't notice. That theater captures our attention, but the fundamental reality is actually, I think, and I argue in the book, that climate change is being driven by an age in which these somewhat inhuman artificial decision-making machines have imperatives and needs and time horizons that do not suit the challenge that we are facing. And just to put it another way, it sounds really hard, you know, if you say, and I believe this is true, that 100 corporations are directly or indirectly responsible for 70% of global carbon emissions. So if you say that, then people think, yeah, but you can't, you know, you can't really sort of change the way corporations behave. You know, corporations are, but we can change. We're human and, you know, we know what's at stake. So really the challenge is to change human behavior. So you often hear this, you know, a lot of the focus of the politics of climate change is how are we going to change human behavior? How are we going to get human beings to be willing to live in a low growth economy, to be willing to make sacrifices, to be willing to take decisions that have long-term benefits but short-term costs? So they put it on us, humans. So I think changing human behavior is much harder than changing corporate behavior. And the reason I think that is that we are natural creatures, right? We have hundreds of thousands of years of evolution built into us, but corporations are just machines. The great thing about machines is that you can change the way they behave. You just rewire them. And so I think we've got it the wrong way around. I mean, the politics is incredibly difficult, but as a basic category understanding, what is harder to get a billion, 2 billion, 5 billion people to change their behavior, or to get 100 corporations to change their behavior? The second is easier, but the politics of it is very difficult for the reasons you say, because it requires getting beyond the theater. And it may already be too late.
The last time I spoke to you, I asked you about this sense of what we were doing. I said, I told you, I just have the feeling that we're playing chess next to the battlefield, and we're imagining that there's a connection between our pieces and what's happening on the battlefield, because that's your job and that's my job and that's how we live. Not that we're colleagues, but, you know, this sense. And you said, well, politics isn't over yet. It might might be at a certain time, but there's still hope for revitalizing the connection between our concepts and the world, the pieces on the chessboard and the battlefield. I have a feeling that this is actually what you're trying to do with this book, trying to inspire us to reimagine what politics could look like.
Yes, and I think, and it connects with the book I wrote a few years ago called How Democracy Ends, which people took to be a pessimistic book, but it was also trying to suggest, if you think that this thing we call democracy is actually, you know, it's a passing phase in the human story, and its successful years were the second half of the 20th century, inevitably there's a sense of grief and loss when it starts to work less well. But we should also take from our knowledge that it's working less well that there are almost endless possibilities for change. And I do think it's a mistake, and we're still in that phase, I think, to keep trying to make it work better without changing it. You know, there's that sort of feeling that if only we just were more serious, found the political will, you got better understanding of our moral commitments, we could make this machine work better. Whereas what I think we could do is try different machines, right? And particularly with democracy, electoral representative party-based 20th century democracy, we don't try many new things. We do a bit, and you see a bit of experimentation in certain places, trying different kinds of citizen participation and so on. But there's very little of it, actually. And also, there's been very little delivery of the promise that this new information technology would allow citizens to be more involved in different ways. But it's almost like we feel that we're giving up on what we call democracy if we start to experiment with it in a radical way. Whereas I think the bigger risk is that we hang on to it because we're comfortable with it and we like the theater of it. There are 100 ways you could do democracy, of which one is modern party-based representative democracy. And it is a 20th century idea, and we are no longer living in the 20th century. The 30 glorious years from 45 to 75 coincided with a particular period in human development and technological development and economic development, which is over, right? It's pre-digital. It allowed for a certain kind of industrial development, which is also probably over or has been shipped out to other parts of the world. It's not happening anymore in some of the countries that thrived in those 30 years. It would be odd if that way of doing politics suited the second and third decade of the 21st century, because so much else has changed. I mean, it would be very surprising to me that the politics that worked, say, in the 1960s would also work in the 2030s. So what is that politics? It is party-based, electoral, mass franchise, transmission communication, so radio, TV, newspapers. Those things are all changing very fast, very dramatically. That would be very surprising if it fitted now. The logical thing to do, the sensible thing to do, would be to try and find a politics that fits now. But we genuinely are not doing that. We are holding on to the one that we think, you know, if we just give it another push, it will work better. If we just try harder, you know, there's a lot of sort of, if we were less apathetic, if we were less pessimistic, if we were more up for it, it would work better. If we got more involved. Well, what about we might get more involved if we changed it, rather than it'll change if we got more involved? But we're stuck. We are still a bit stuck. I think it is starting to shift. I suspect over the next 5 to 10 years, we will see quite dramatic shifts, some for better, some for worse. I think some democracies will collapse, probably. I think other places will see more radical experimentation. But at the moment, we're in that stuck phase. And yeah, I would think we should get unstuck. And one way to get unstuck is to recognize, well, we could change. Yeah, maybe we'll change. I'm not going to change. You're not going to change. People don't change much, right? But we could try. Or we could change the way we do it.
I feel that the kind of radical experimentation that is required of this moment and the situation that you put out in the book is more suited for the kind of confidence that we had in the 90s. Whereas in this moment, that there's a very conservative tendency among all liberal Democrats that you just want to hold on to what you have, because otherwise comes Trump, otherwise comes Liz Truss, otherwise comes Erdogan, otherwise comes Rassemblement National in France, otherwise comes the Nationalist. There's this sense that what we have is not good enough, it's not functioning, it's not solving our problems, but the immediate alternative is decline. And should we, in your view, be courageous enough to say, well, maybe this is the moment where everything is up for negotiation, and instead of just defending liberal institutions, we should seize the... I think this is what happened with the trade policies and the globalization of Biden, actually, that Trump broke down something and enabled him to pursue a more progressive agenda and did something that would never have been done without Trump. But do you think this is the mindset that we should go into this very difficult political year with?
So yeah, I do. I do think we should be more courageous. I think it's dangerous to think, you know, let's wait for someone to break it and that will give us the opportunity to do something new. Although I think you're right. I think that, you know, there's always opportunity in moments of, for want of a better phrase, creative destruction in politics. But I also think there's a bigger picture here. You know, so you say we, I don't know, liberal Democrats, whatever it is that we are, right? We're holding on and we're nervous and we don't want to experiment. But we're living in a profoundly experimental world. There is political experimentation going on, including, you know, in non-democratic settings. I mean, there's probably more political experimentation happening in China than in the United States. But also, there's an enormous amount of experimentation happening outside of politics. And you know, while liberal Democrats are holding on to what they've got, Silicon Valley corporations are trying out 20 new things a day, many of which do have profound behavioral impacts on how human beings coexist. I mean, we know that. We're almost certainly, all of us, subject to a vast experiment in how we interact with each other, over which we have very little control. And while we're clinging on to this liberal democratic politics that we think we can revitalize with a bit more effort, the real experimentation is happening elsewhere. And one of the risks is not just Liz Truss, right? I like the way that she, as you describe it, is the sort of thing we're trying to avoid. But one of the risks is that actually we are moving to a world in which more and more of our collective decision-making happens outside of the political domain. And there may be benefits to that. There are almost certainly efficiency benefits to that. Democracy is pretty inefficient. Certainly analog representative democracy is pretty inefficient relative to what might be possible with this technology. But that will, I am certain, accelerate the humanizing qualities of the artificial decision-making world that we have built. You know, there will be costs to this greater efficiency, this ability to collectively decide our fate outside of the political arena through different kinds of interactions, primarily economic interactions. And there are huge risks, I think, to, while we are focused on the human, the people who are building the new machines, forming alliances with the people who ran the old machines, you know, government and Silicon Valley, or the Chinese state and the Chinese technology companies, form alliances with each other. And in 20 years' time, we might find that this is a radically less human world, because we were clinging on to a version of what it means to be human at the time where these different kinds of artificial versions of us were forming alliances with each other. And we need to re-inject the human into those systems. And the only way we can do that is if we do accept that we've got to be more courageous. We've got to be willing to break them. You know, we've got to be willing to step in there. I think the phrase I use in my book is, we've got to put human grit in the machine, right? You've got to stop them working in some ways so that they recognize us. You've got to break them so that they can work better. And yeah, that does require courage for sure.
Do you think that combating climate change could be seen as a teaching moment? Because if you look at what's happening in Dubai, for instance, at COP28, then everyone is forced to recognize that policies are not only in politics, that we have big corporations and the way you construct your cities. You have to reimagine your political action to combat climate change. And I feel that those who are engaged in that, they start looking at the corporate machines. They start looking at what can be done at a collective level. I find that very hopeful.
Yeah, and I think there are lots of hopeful things happening around climate change. The key question, as always, is how much time do we have to be taught relative to how much time do we have before we have to act? And it all depends how long the teaching moment is. But there is no question there is a lot of learning happening about what's possible and also about some of the rewiring that's going to be necessary. But I still think we're very uncertain about the timeframes for this. And I'm uncertain. I have no idea, right? I just have no idea whether the future scenarios here are very, very wide, or we're already quite a long way down a path it's going to be quite hard to get off. I just don't know. But we definitely don't have a lot of time for teaching. It's not like for climate change, what we need is to go back to school for 10 years and then sort it. I don't think we have those 10 years, probably. I mean, I don't think the world's going to end, but I don't think we could spend 10 years learning. But there is a lot of learning happening and there's a lot of action happening. I don't think the story on climate change is doom and gloom by any means. But for the reasons you say, something needs to drive quickly that sense that how we organize the economic and political structure of the world is a series of interconnected, codependent, in my mind, mechanical relationships between artificial versions of human beings that we human beings have got to remind exist to serve us.
And your book is definitely very, very helpful and inspirational in that moment. David Runciman, thank you so much for taking your time and talking to us again.
It's a pleasure. Thank you.
Det var så min samtale med David Runciman. Bogen hedder Overdragelsen, hvordan vi gav magten til stater, selskaber og kunstig intelligens. Den er udkommet på Informationsforlag, og den har den vidunderlige kvalitet, at det er en let og underholdende, men samtidig tung og klog bog at læse, så vi får det bedste fra begge verdener i den. Hvis man gerne vil købe den, og det kan man jo også, for det er os, der har udgivet den, så går man ind på butik.information.dk, og derinde klikker man, og så kan man som abonnent få 15% rabat for bogen, og det vil sige, en bog, der ellers skulle koste 300 kroner, kan man derinde få 255 kroner. Jeg lover jer, det er ikke et køb, I kommer til at fortryde. Den her samtale var produceret af vores vidunderlige ven og hjælper, Albert Kuhlmann. I næste uge skal vi tale med en anden, som vi regner for en ven af huset, og som vi har haft i langsomme samtaler før, nemlig den enestående amerikanske essayist Rebecca Solnit. Vi skal tale om hendes bog, Hvis historie er det, som er udkommet på Informationsforlag, også i vores feminisme-klassiker-bibliotek. Så jeg håber, I vil være med i næste uge, når Rebecca Solnit og jeg, vi tager den store tur gennem aktivismen i dag, gennem håbet i dag, gennem bevægelserne i dag og gennem feminismen i dag. Mit navn er Rune Lykkeberg. Tusind tak for, at I lyttede med.